So thank you for inviting me. For these Thursday nights, the theme is going to be, and you might have seen this, healing and awakening on the spiritual path. Tonight I'm going to be introducing these two aspects or these two realms of the spiritual path, both healing and awakening. And some words I'm going to be using interchangeably with them is the kind of the personal realm and the transpersonal realm. And I'll be explaining these terms. Actually, it's what I'm going to do mostly tonight, to explain this distinction and why we would want to make this distinction and the usefulness of it. And then the last, and so that will be the talk tonight, is more of an introduction. The next talk, I'm going to look more deeply into this aspect of healing on this path, and also some blind spots that can arise when we're on a spiritual path, which I found really important to reflect upon. And then the talk after that will be awakening, which I think is also going to be important, just for you to reflect, what does awakening mean? What is that? And the last talk will be on family and lineage, which you'll notice when I give the talk will fit in quite well. And a few things about some of the other activities that are going to be situated around this. And I want to be really clear. It's not like you have to do all the activities or you have to be here on the Thursday night in order to go to the study group. It's really what works for you. But the study group is going to be along these lines. For example, Monday night, we're going to be meeting at the Rigson Center. Essay we're going to be looking at, Promises and Perils on the Spiritual Path, is going to be about this personal aspect of the path and some things that are important to notice when we're on a spiritual path. And then we're also going to read an essay by Jack Kornfield about awakening. He entitles it Enlightenments. And I think it's a wonderful essay to begin to reflect upon what is this word enlightenment? What is this thing awakening? And to begin to discuss that together through this study group. I need to also mention Sunday nights and this Monday morning thing, because that's going to be a different thing. The other topic that I wanted to share with you, explore together with you, is on Sunday evenings, while I'm here, I'll be speaking about bringing the spiritual practice into our daily lives. Most of us, that's what we want to do, is we want to fully embody this. So I'll be speaking about that on Sunday evenings, and then Monday mornings is a time to get together with a group and discuss that. And we'll be meeting in the morning, and what it will consist of is sitting together. But I invite you to also, if you have time Monday morning, to come to reflect upon if there's some way you want to deepen your practice. And sometimes just using these Monday mornings while I'm here might help enable that. For example, you might want to make more of a commitment to do a little more sitting in your daily life. Or it might be taking up something around skillful speech. Or practicing more kindness. There's a lot of different facets, but something to bring it into our lives in some way, or doing some kind of daily mindfulness practice, like being mindful while you're brushing your teeth or something like that. But it could be something basic, but I always find having the support of the group is so helpful. You notice that? That's why we get together, right? Is we can get support. And I'm sure many of you here, because you know what it is to get support from a group, it makes a difference. So that Monday morning is just for that. So again, healing and awakening. I'm equating the personal with this aspect of healing and the transpersonal with this aspect of awakening. Before I get into the details of how I'm distinguishing these, I want to speak about why I want to talk about this. First of all, it is an investigation that's been important for my spiritual practice. One point, just the beginning point, and I'm sure many of you can relate to this, is that healing and awakening, that's why we're doing this path, right? Many of you probably are interested or fascinated with this spiritual path or engaging in it because you've had some taste of the healing that can come from it. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's changed your life, maybe in a significant way or in a subtle yet profound way. And there's something that compels you as a result of that. Or some taste of awakening, or something that even goes beyond kind of this quality of my life that you've gotten a taste of. And which has made, again, the spiritual path something that is compelling for you. That's why I want to talk about it, because it's the same for me. I've experienced both healing and awakening on this path. It's something that makes it compelling. But it's not only that. I've noticed within my own spiritual practice, and I've noticed this more and more as I teach and I talk with people about their practice, and we share our practices together, that sometimes what happens is that on a spiritual path, people can disregard personal healing that needs to happen. or a personal investigation that needs to happen. There's a term for it called spiritual bypassing, which I'll speak more about, especially in the next talk, and I'll touch upon it tonight. Or meditation and the spiritual path can only be about personal healing, where it's about my life and making my life better, or my personal issues. Both are great things, but it can really hinder, I think, the unfolding of this path if we forget one or the other. And I want to be clear, I'm using this distinction because I found it useful. And I want to acknowledge at times, this distinction is not going to be useful. This is just a tool that can help with reflection, and I think understanding this path on a deeper level, and understanding our own path. And again, what comes with that whenever we make a distinction is that it might sound like it's this clear, distinct line, and you'll notice that it's not that clear and distinct. But again, you might see that it's helpful. So let's get to these terms. How am I using these terms? And what I'm going to share with you tonight is I've decided I'm going to share with you a few different metaphors that might be helpful for understanding this distinction. And I think as I begin to use these metaphors, one or the other might fit for you. And things about your practice might fit in with that, or some kind of understanding might come with that. The first metaphor I'm going to use to distinguish between healing and awakening, or this personal aspect, or this transpersonal aspect, is a metaphor that Ken Wilber once used. He said that kind of personal work, it's as if both in healing and awakening we have this quality of observation, but then we put a lens on it. And we can put a certain kind of lens on it. We can put a lens on it where we're looking at our experience through this personal lens, or we're looking at experience through this transpersonal lens. The way he makes the distinction is as if in terms of the transpersonal, it's seen that this reality is just a dream. You think it's more real than it is, but then we actually realize it's just a dream. And then for the personal work, he says that it's not really seeing the dream as a dream, that it's just a dream. It's making sure that the dream doesn't become a nightmare. So a little more details about this. Both are really important. It's very difficult to see the dream as just a dream if the dream's a nightmare. What do I mean by seeing the dream as just a dream? In terms of this practice, it's coming to realize that we have these misperceptions about reality. And I'm sure that this has been taught about here on Thursday nights. You know, the three classic ones is that we think that things are permanent that are actually impermanent. And when we do that, we end up suffering more. Have you ever noticed, like, when your computer breaks, you're surprised? Oh my God, I can't believe it broke today. Why is the internet connection not working? As if it should be permanent. But then we can have this realization, oh, actually, computers are impermanent. Oh, I thought it was more real than it was. I thought it was more permanent than it was. So I'm using dream in that sense, in the sense that we see, oh, okay, so it's actually more impermanent than I was making it to be. I wasn't seeing it that way. I wasn't seeing so clearly. So we clarify that misperception, and then we don't suffer as much as a result of that. And I want to point out, it's really important to notice, even though I'm using this word dream, we're still cultivating this quality of caring about the dream. Many times when I talk about seeing the dream as just a dream, many times people equate that with this feeling of, oh, maybe I can be, have this sense of apathy about what's going on. We're not talking about that. And for some of you, you might notice that when you start to see that reality is more impermanent than you thought it was, or more unreliable, or that there's not a fixed identity there, that sometimes there can be this intimacy with our experience in a way that our hearts are more open and that there is more caring, a wise kind of caring. So that's the transpersonal, and I'll go into more detail about that. And then, yes, the personal, making sure that the dream doesn't become a nightmare. Let me give some examples about this. Jack Kornfield tells a story of somebody who, there's a guy in England who went through divorce and then decided to go to India. He went to India for 10 years. He practiced in India for 10 years. I think probably had some really wonderful openings in his spiritual practice, maybe even on this transpersonal level. And then after 10 years of spiritual practice, he comes back to England and he realizes that he's faced with the same old problems that were there before he left. Namely, one was loneliness, depression, And the other thing he started to realize is that these patterns that led to his divorce are still happening in his life. I imagine that it wasn't the most pleasant awakening experience when he came back to the U.S. But you might notice this. I mean, sometimes we meditate and we think that it's going to take care of all of these things, and then we come back into our lives and it's like, oh my God, I still have these problems. I'm still as neurotic as I was before I started. What's up with this? Where's the goodies? So this is what he was faced with. And luckily he had the wisdom to see that he had to do personal work. So what he did, what I'd put in this realm is he probably did a lot of, he was still meditating, so that was part of it, because awareness is such a big part of healing. But he had to look at these patterns that were particular to his life, his own personal history. So he had to look at these patterns probably from childhood and the stories that were there. He might have had to be aware of the events he went through, maybe traumatic events that he went through, or neglect, or what he learned from his parents, in order to see these patterns that were not serving him, and so that he could start to become free of them. But it was about his personal life, his own life, his individual life. And that when he started to do that, it helped ameliorate the loneliness and the depression. It might have given him a better self-image, that he was able to create a better self-image rather than the poor self-image that he had. This can be really important work to do on a spiritual path. And you might notice in this description I'm giving you, do you hear that some of the big components of this is story and meaning? This is the personal realm. Story in terms of the things that have happened to him. Meaning. What are the meanings that he's put onto his experience? And when he did that work, it cut down on the nightmare. He was freer on some level, on a personal level. But there's also this other lens that we can put on the observation, which is different than that, this transpersonal lens. With this lens, I'm not so concerned about the personal story around experience. So for example, if I'm meditating or I'm observing my experience and there's a sense of, I feel down or there's a sense of depression, I'm not examining the story behind it or the patterns, my personal patterns. I begin to notice something that's broader. What's the mind's reaction to it? Oh, there's not liking. Oh, there's really this pushing away of this kind of this down, low energy state. Oh, interesting. And when that quality of not liking, that state of mind of not liking begins to dissipate, there can be more of this capacity, this okayness with whatever arises. Interesting. And I notice that the experience, it comes in and goes. Sometimes it increases and decreases. Do you hear with this lens, I'm not looking at my personal story. I'm noticing more of these kind of broader categories of states of mind, and also broader categories of the flavor or the qualities of experience, that it comes and goes. That there can be grasping and pushing and how that can complicate the suffering. But it's a little bit different lens. I'm not taking up my personal story on this transpersonal level. I want to give two examples of this. Actually, this just happened a few days ago with a client of mine where they were coming in and in some ways we were exploring some of their difficulty through this personal lens. But then in the middle of the session, there was this realization that the client had where he said, wow, it's just what's happening right now is the mind is constricted. And all I need to do, and he was referring back to the four foundations of mindfulness, I just need to be the practitioner that notices that a constricted mind is arising. Oh, interesting. And I've been really exploring how my personal life has been intertwined with this, but now I can feel the freedom when I can just simply observe it as a constricted mind rather than something that's about my personal story. But he was touching his experience on the transpersonal level. Do you hear this? He was more interested in this broader view of it. And then one other example of this that's a little more dramatic. And I want to point out, I'm going to be giving at times some dramatic examples. And I want to point out, for most of us, the way our spiritual practice unfolds is it's not going to be that dramatic, but it can be just as profound. So please don't be looking for the dramatic. This is still an interesting description. So this practitioner says, everything I knew of the world shattered open. I could not say what was left, for there was nothing of myself at all. There was that which is here before the sense of self ever existed. I knew once and for all that there is no self, that any sense of self is an illusion. We are empty like a dream, a play of mind. Gradually, some of the world came back, though in many ways my sense of it had changed completely. Transpersonal, right? That's a flavor of awakening, different than personal healing. Again, the personal, it cuts down on the nightmare. So the nightmare, the dream does not become a nightmare. The transpersonal, we're seeing the dream is just a dream, more of the essence of our experience. Another way of understanding this, another way of understanding the personal healing that we do is that we begin to break through these personal projections. Maybe some of you have noticed this. We can walk around and we can project all kinds of crazy things on the people. Ever notice that? There can be this underlying assumption that people don't like us. And we can believe that with nothing coming from the external, our external environment. And then we project that onto others. They give us a strange look. Oh, they must not like me. And it might be true. But the problem is that we have a belief system that we're imposing on to reality. And a lot of times those personal projections has to do with my individual personal history. Maybe when I was growing up, I was being given these messages, sometimes from caregivers, and that it gets so implanted that then I think that's the way the world is. And then with personal work, for some of you who have done important personal healing and personal work, we begin to challenge those. Oh, actually, that's just a belief. That's just a projection. That's actually not what's going on right now. And the freedom from that. Have you noticed the freedom from that? When we can own our personal projections. This is really important for living. It's important for ourselves, and it's also important for others. Most people are happier around me when I'm not projecting on them. It's a good thing. You could say on the transpersonal level, we're doing the same thing, but we're working with deeper projections. For example, the one I gave. I have this projection believing that the world that I live in is more permanent than it really is, or that it's more reliable than it is. And with practice, with spiritual practice, I begin to cut through those projections. Or I believe that there's a solid sense of identity within my experience. But then with more examination, I notice that ain't true. Or in other ways, sometimes we have this feeling that here I am, and I am observing the world out there. So there's me and the world. So there's a sense of this dualistic experience where the observer's right here, and then you all are the ones I'm observing. But then with more examination, that can start to break down, where there's this quality of maybe that the mind is just creating this dualistic fixation, that it's a projection that really isn't essentially true. Again, that really doesn't have to do with my personal history. It's more on the transpersonal. And then one last image that might be helpful. One of the things I like to do when I'm in Flagstaff, I don't know how many of you have been to Flagstaff. When you come to Flagstaff, you have the city there, and then behind the city are all these mountains. And one of the mountains that's closest to Flagstaff is Mount Eldon. And where I live, it's wonderful because within probably about 10 minutes, I can walk into the forest. If I ride my bike in about a half an hour, ride my bike part of the way and then I hike up, I can get to a point where I can overlook the city. And it's great. I love it. Because I'm in the pine trees, these huge ponderosa pine trees around me, on the side of the steep mountain. And it gives me this whole different view of the city I live in. And when I'm up there and I really take some time just to hang out, there can be such a feeling of relief. Because what I can start to do is I really start to take my life really seriously and my world really seriously. And when I'm up there on the side of the mountain, it looks so small. It's such a good reminder how small my world is, and such a relief. Some of you might experience that, for example, when you go for a hike, where it puts things in a little bit different perspective. And it's very, very valuable for my life to have these kinds of tastes, a different taste or a different perspective of the world I live in. But I also need to know how to function in the city, because I got to pay bills. I need to know how to interact with people. So city life is important too. In the same way, I think what I'm trying to propose is both the personal and the transpersonal are essential for a healthy spiritual path. I need the transpersonal to get a much broader view of this small personal world that I usually live in. That's where the deep realization comes from. But if I'm always up there on the mountain of awakening or the transpersonal, then I can forget what it is to be a human being and how to skillfully navigate that and how to bring that broad view I get up from up above the mountain back into the city. Can you relate to this at all? And sometimes you might notice you get that from meditation, right? It gives you, it shakes something up. Maybe it just gives a little bit more space so that when you go back into your life, you can bring some of that along. And you can act, you can live in a different way. So a few more details about this. So when I lose sight of the skills I need to live in the city, when I lose sight of this personal realm, there's actually a word for this. It's called spiritual bypassing, where somebody can go onto a spiritual path. And some of you might notice this about your own spiritual path. I definitely, if this is something that I have engaged in. And I engage in a spiritual path in the hopes that it will take care of all my personal issues that I have. I really wish that happened. It would have been awesome. I was really bummed out when it didn't work out. And I actually needed to take some time to do some personal work, which meant not only, for me, it was seeing that there were some things in my personal life that meditation wasn't going to help. I needed to do more of this personal investigation. It was essential. This is something that can infuse spiritual communities too, where when the spiritual work is neglected, a lot of times an unhealthy community can arise. I lived in one for many years. The Zen community that I lived in, the Zen master, I still feel like he's an amazing Zen master. He really, the way he talks about practice is amazing, and I am extremely grateful to him. But because of some of his personal misgivings and an unwillingness to look at it, and in a community that was willing to keep the secret, especially in Zen, it's always around sexual misconduct, right? It's a horrible secret, and that's one of the reasons I like to talk about it, not so much to disparage people, because it's a secret, and it's the kind of secret that creates harm. And it was because there was this spiritual bypassing that was going on that we don't talk about that. And not only that, that behavior is spiritual anyway. And that's an indication of the personal realm being forgotten. So there can be something dangerous about this in terms of community and in terms of our own lives. And so many times these are places that are difficult to see. I'm blind to my personal, you know, these my personal issues for a reason. I don't want to take a look at them. So sometimes I need the help of another person. The other reason this is so important, I want to tie it in to an importance of having a strong sense of self. And again, this is the importance of personal work, and it's something that we can gain from a spiritual practice as well, the personal healing that can come by engaging in the spiritual path. Jack Engler said about this path, he says, you must be somebody before you can be nobody. This is important. That you need to have a strong sense of self before you can go beyond that. I want to speak about why that is. Why is that the case, and why did the Buddha not talk about it? One thing I just want to make a note of is that next time, another thing that I want to touch upon is just things, indications in your spiritual practice where you might have to do a little more personal work. But I'll talk about that for the next talk. Why didn't the Buddha talk about personal healing? Why do we have this division now? What's up with this? I feel that healing, the way I'm talking about it, and even things like the psychotherapeutic process at times, can be essential or really important given our modern sense of self. And I want to point out that our modern sense of self is so radically different. In the last, since the 1600s, the sense of self has really changed dramatically. This is from a book by Anne Klein. Anne Klein wrote this book called Meeting the Great Bliss Queen, which is, she comes from the Tibetan tradition, but she's looking at this issue of individuality, and she's examining it. She says, basically she's talking about the modern sense of self. These days, actually let me back up before I give this quote. I forgot one thing. I think the big difference with the modern sense of self compared to the way it was during the Buddha's time is that you might notice that we choose things for our lives in a different manner. Let me explain this. It used to be the decision about what job I would have. If I was a man, what job I would have in many cultures. If you're a woman, who you would marry. Even if you're a man, who would you marry? Or what religion you would practice. Even what you would eat, where you would live, and what you would wear was determined by your family and the community around your family. These weren't decisions that were made on an individual basis. It would be unheard of to do such a thing. I couldn't imagine making those kinds of decisions. Whereas now, this is what Anne Klein points out. She says, quote, "We make life choices now based on one's own preferences, one's own personality and power." Power also plays a big role. So now you might notice, how do we make choices? We make choices because I have this sense that of being some kind of unique individual. Family still might play a role, but I have a different sense of myself as being an individual that's separate from my family and my community. Not this self that is interwoven within my family. And as a result of that, my sense of myself is vastly more complex. And you might notice this just as you've lived your life, the complexities of figuring out what job you want to do, the food you want to eat, the spiritual path you want to take, who's going to be your partner. These are complicated questions. What do you want to do with your life? The question of what you want to do with your life wouldn't have come up back then as much. So in that sense, in this modern world, it's going to take much more work to have a more stable sense of self because the world that we live in is much more complex. What do we get out of a strong sense of self? I just want to make sure, is this making sense? And can you relate to this in the sense of the complexities that we have to face that we wouldn't have had to face probably in the Buddhist time? It's a whole different world. And when I get clear about those things, I start to create a strong sense of self. What do we get from that? I know this is going to sound strange, but I think this is the way it works. I think many times when we have a strong sense of self, it provides kind of a false ground that I need to navigate the groundlessness that comes from a spiritual path. A spiritual path, you might notice, can be incredibly disruptive. It's a good thing. And in order to have the capacity for that, I need a strong sense of self to navigate that. A strong sense of a false self. It's important. You could say it's developmentally important. And I know there's actually examples of people that don't have one and have amazing, dramatic stories of awakening. But on the whole, I notice that. Many times what happens when somebody doesn't have a strong sense of self and they really engage in spiritual practice, a lot of times then there's just this bypassing that happens. Or there can be a disintegration that's unhelpful. It says I'm still wondering if this is true or not, but I'm so intrigued by the analogy, I got to tell you. I've been told that in order to skillfully walk or to have walking really come online physiologically appropriately, one has to crawl beforehand. It's just developmentally appropriate. We usually learn to crawl and then we learn to walk. And there are some instances I've heard of people walking before they crawl, and that they're told that they should go back and practice crawling because there's something missing with their gait and their walking, so that it's important to go through those steps. I don't know, does anybody know if that's true or not? It's a really great analogy, but I should think about this.
Maybe it's cross crawling. This motion is what it is. Necessary.
Oh, that kind of movement is necessary so that it, for the development, so that you can walk. Thank you. Yeah.
Before your brain. It's for your brain.
Yes. Yeah. And the same thing might be true in terms of having a clear sense of self, so that when we go beyond the sense of self, there's more capacity for that. There's a developmental process for this. So the personal is really important. But also the transpersonal is extremely important. There can be something narrow, very narrow. You notice there can be something very narrow if we come to our spiritual path only for personal healing. It's like we're missing out on the big goodies. And that's freedom. That's awakening. And I think many times that comes, as I've noticed, is that sometimes we can have this sense. You might have this sense that awakening is not for me, or freedom is not for me, as if it's some big thing that's beyond me. It's only for those monastics in Asia. But it's not true. Awakening is possible to some degree for all of us, this transpersonal realm. It's coming to have confidence in that. It's true I've divided these up, that we do our personal work, there's personal healing, the transpersonal comes in and we have these transpersonal insights. I want to acknowledge, though, that these can happen at the same time. And just one example of this, there's a practitioner I was talking with, another remarkable story. Someone who actually had done a lot of psychotherapeutic work and is also extremely dedicated to meditation. Somebody I have found has just a deep faith in doing the practice and not worrying about the outcome. This person also was somebody who struggled with a very clear, fragmented personality. Severe fragmentation in the personality, many personalities. Sometimes I hesitate to say that because I really wonder if anybody has one personality. So there's something a little bit amiss about that. But serious fragmentation happened in this person's psyche when they were younger. And this is something that just kept on coming up in their practice. So they worked with it psychotherapeutically. They just did the practice. And on a retreat, it was as if the self completely dropped away, like in that description I gave. And the fragmentation completely disappeared in that moment. It was unbelievable. So it was as if there was this tremendous personal healing that happened along with this transpersonal insight, a very deep transpersonal insight. So I'm dividing them up more so we can see our blind spots, but they really can come together like that.
Was he healed afterwards?
The fragmentation for she never happened again. It was the first time in their experience. They said they'd always had this fragmentation for their entire lives. They had never experienced existing without that. And then it dropped away, completely dropped away. Yeah. Yeah, it was remarkable. I was so amazed when I heard it. Yeah. But I think that this path really has that potential to it when we dedicate it. And the other element, I just want to share the other element that I think was so remarkable, is this was a practitioner also that was just dedicated to sitting. They would sit, not only sitting, but ethical conduct and reflection, like the reflections that we talk about on the Buddhist path in terms of reflecting on one's own mortality. But the willingness to sit through anything also, and to be really curious about their ethical conduct and keeping at it. And for many years sometimes without any kind of dramatic happening. And even now in their practice, the thing that I think is so impressive is they're not looking for anything dramatic either. They're just interested in sitting, ethical conduct, reflecting. That's what their lives are about. Very simple. So I invite you to, especially if you want to come to the study groups. There's a chance to look at this more deeply, these two different realms, and to get an understanding of them. And I invite you to reflect on that. If there's a sense, you might have a sense in your spiritual practice if one of these is being neglected. Well, I feel like I don't need to do any personal work. I just need to meditate. That's sometimes an indication. That was my indication. I hate to admit it. I spent many years bad-mouthing personal work. It was the hip thing when I was a Zen monk, and the Zen thing was something that was looked down upon. Why'd I do that? Because I hadn't done any of my personal work. But also to examine, is my spiritual path only about my personal issues? Because that's what it's all about. Do I only have that lens on it? Am I only looking at my family history? Am I missing out on some of these transpersonal aspects? Like, for example, the simple insight of seeing impermanence or seeing unsatisfactoriness. To notice that. Yeah, so I think this is it for tonight. So may healing and awakening unfold on our spiritual path, both for ourselves and for others. Any questions or comments or anything you'd like to share?
Well, I'm very grateful for your talk.
Okay. Thank you.
So when it comes to the transpersonal stuff, you go after it, you see faith. So similarly, do you also go and seek for your personal stuff? If one tried to like raking a mark to get all the food. I don't think you were trying to say that, but I guess it's just
a great question. Yeah, and you might have ideas about this too, or other people might have ideas about this. I can only tell you from my own experience, it's more the personal investigation or exploration I've had to do, I've done in a few different ways. One is just reflection, reflecting on what I've been given from my family history, both the good and the bad. Like, don't forget the good, please. But also seeing those things. And so it's more reflection in terms of that, not so much meditation. That's been one thing. And so noticing tendencies that happen during the day, but not always the meditative path, but also seeing these habitual dynamics in terms of that has been helpful. Does that make sense? So it's not so much raking in the mud, it's just noticing. It's still centered around awareness. That's the unifying factor for both of these. I go through my day and there's these strange, quirky thing that happens that causes me suffering, and I beat myself up in a certain way. And then it's like, wow, isn't that interesting? That person didn't say anything, and yet I beat myself up about it. So then I might, that could be either a personal exploration, or I could reflect on it even on the transpersonal level. So, yeah, not necessarily raking up, but that might be a way of dealing with it that's effective. Yeah. Not that I know of, though. Is that helpful? I don't know if it's answering your question or... And there might be other ways of exploring that personal realm. It's just something that I've engaged in that's been helpful for me.
Brian, you used the term a couple times early on, constricted mind. Oh. And could you elaborate what that is? And I presume it's perhaps just simply the opposite of being in a transpersonal awareness or personal awareness?
Actually, I was using it in terms of a specific example. So a constricted mind being, in terms of the way this individual is using it, is just that there was, maybe another word is a lot of resistance or not liking, or a feeling also shutting down. Like he described it as like his whole system was shutting down. And it was very unpleasant. And what I was describing is that he had spent so much time connecting this with his family history and the meaning of it in his life and how it was ruining his life. And then there was this moment where it's like, oh, the mind's constricted and it's impermanent. It was very, very simple, but very profound for this individual. And that was an insight on the transpersonal level. He wasn't trying to figure it out on the personal level anymore. It was just a state of mind, that's all it was. And that was what was so freeing to him. It was like, this can, and then after the session, it was like, oh, this can come up whenever it wants to. Rather than, oh my God, there's this pattern in my life, and I've come to you because I need to get rid of it. And I'm wondering if you can help me figure it out, because it's connected with my family and what my father told me and stuff like this, which was true. And that also, at times in our sessions, was very fruitful. A lot of healing came from that and freedom. But this was a different kind of freedom. Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm. A little constricted.
Maybe somebody else can add. Maybe there's a different way of explaining it. There's an important distinction, though. Is it making sense to anybody?
Phew. Uh-huh. Recognize it well. Can you give us just a little bit of your spiritual background? How you got here today?
Yeah, just I became interested in meditation and that kind of stuff when I was in high school, and then in college I studied philosophy, which got me even more interested in meditation, because I realized that thinking, it was like I came face to face with my thinking mind, which was a very miserable experience. And at that point, it was mostly Zen, actually, but I was also beginning to practice Vipassana. Went to India, got more interested in Vipassana, but then I went the Zen route. I lived for 6 years in a Zen monastery. Mm-hmm. But after that, I really fell in love with Vipassana. I went over to Burma and practiced there. There's a teacher in Nepal. There's centers here in the States I went to and kind of did the Dharma bum thing for a while. And then started teaching. I started teaching at a drug rehab, and then a group in Silver City had me join them, and then it just kind of expanded. Oh, and then also a teacher of mine, Eric Kolvig, started to mentor me in this process, which I'm extremely grateful for, to have this model of what it is to teach and to be. So that's the short and simple. Is that helpful? Thank you very much. So I hope to see you at...